Okay, that wasn't too chaotic, was it? Good, thank you. Yes, I have the iPod, but I don't have the regular microphone. No problem. The iPod's fine. Thank you. I knew I wasn't ready. I just didn't know why. Okay. There we go. Okay, if you didn't get the book and need it, we have them, or they will be in the office forever until I run out. So, there we go. $6, yeah. That's cost plus, I am actually making a profit to pay for the one I gave you. 19 cents each. I will declare it as income. January 25th. 11 months till Christmas. Robert Burns' birthday. Who was in five last fall? Remember the discussion in cognitive development of metaphor and simile? My love is like a red, red rose. That's Robert Burns. And his birthday is today. Okay. And because his birthday is today, and I was listening to the radio when they were announcing that it was his birthday, they gave examples of three or four of his best-known poems, and one of them was My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose. There. So, see? Listen to the radio, you learn something. He also wrote Auld Lang Syne. There, now you have your factoid for the day. I was afraid somebody would ask. I don't know when he was born. Does anybody know? We could Google him and find out, but we don't need to do that. Whose birthday is Friday? Yours. All right. Happy birthday. In order to celebrate your birthday, we are not having class on Friday. How's that? That's your present. Okay. This class will not meet on Friday in honor of Anna's birthday. Thank you. It is also somebody else's birthday, do you know? No. 250th. Mozart. Got it. Okay. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was born 250 years ago on the 27th. Okay. Foolishness aside, questions?
How important is knowing like the color thing?
How important is knowing the color?
I am colorblind, so I have like a bit of a difficult time coloring. So
thank you. Can you distinguish which phrases are separated by color?
Yeah, but I have no idea what colors they are.
Okay, good. I was hoping you would know which phrases are distinguished. The specific color has nothing to do with anything.
Okay.
So that's not important. But make a note. Because there is a form of color blindness in which a person would not be able to know which were distinguished except as gray, and it wouldn't, in this light, it would not work well at all. And I had never thought about that, so thank you for bringing that to my attention. Okay. The specific colors do not matter. They probably say something about my personality or my psychology or something, but... It is cut off on the right-hand side, yeah. But... How's that? Okay. Other questions? Should the assignments be double spaced? The long ones, yes. I guess it doesn't matter for this one. I deferred to Julie. The others should be, yes. Anything that's of any length should be. But I'm going to change the rules a bit. Okay. I'm a big fan of space and a half. And you can tell that if you look at the book. The book is space and a half. It would be longer if it were double spaced. It would also waste more. I mean, it would take more paper. It wouldn't be wasted. Okay. So the exercises, the first one doesn't matter because it's short enough that Julie can probably deal. But after that, things should be spaced and a half or doubled. It just makes it a lot easier to read, especially if your printer does anything that's unusual. Okay. Housekeeping details. Nothing else? Okay. We have talked a little bit about development generally. I threw this definition 7 up again to remind you. Several of you have asked me to send you the color versions of the overheads, and I'm happy to do that. If I did, and I did, I mean, if you did, and I did they come through okay? Were you able to open them? Anybody have difficulty? Did anybody get them successfully? That's really my question. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So the system is working. Okay. Then, where do we want to go? We're going to launch right into Bronfenbrenner's framework. And Bronfenbrenner's framework starts off with the notion that human beings are active organisms. And we are active in exploring our environment. We're active in learning. We're active in engaging in transactions with other people and with our environment. And we're active in practicing the skills of coping with or engaging with our environment. So activity is central. The basic assumption about human beings and essential to understanding our development. What kinds of activities are important? Bronfenbrenner distinguishes what he calls a molar activity. Anybody have any idea why he calls it molar? Any chemistry majors? No? Okay. Then I can say anything I want. Molar, in Bronfenbrenner's use of it, is intended to imply important or kind of big. And the contrast is to the word molecular. When something is molecular, like a molecule, it's relative to other things, small. And small. And what he intends to denote for you here is that there are lots of actions that we take that are of little consequence. They may be really, really important in some ways, like breathing, for for example. But once you've learned to breathe, which most of us do within the first couple of minutes after delivery, once you've got that down, you just do it the rest of your life. It doesn't go anywhere. It's essential, but it doesn't go anywhere. We engage in activities, other activities that are molecular. They're little, they may be important in the big picture, but they're not important developmentally. We scan the environment constantly. We engage in eye movements. We do the postural adjustments that keep us standing upright while we walk around. We snap our fingers when we walk. Some of us hum tunelessly and intentlessly because we're just losing track of what our voices are doing. Okay. And some of us have annoying habits like a I took a course in college with a professor who was on abnormal psychology, and through the entire course, he was a very famous psychologist, family therapist, John Spiegel. Through the entire course, he lectured this way, except his tables were higher so he could actually suspend, and he just swung between them and went. And neither of those activities, the suspension or the nervous tick, you know, clearing his adenoids, whatever he was doing, it was really annoying. Neither of those had any meaning or any intent. He didn't intend to do them. He was, I'm sure, pretty much unaware that he was doing them, and probably would have quit them if he could have, but they weren't important developmentally.
They were probably really important psychologically in figuring out why he was doing them.
And we spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. But they weren't things he had learned to do or spent any time doing, and they didn't help him in any way. They weren't useful, I think. I mean, I can't find any other than taking care of the postnasal drip, I guess. Bronfenbrenner wants to let us know that we don't have to think about those behaviors. They're molecular. What he's interested in is the behaviors, the activities that we engage in, that we have to spend some effort to learn, and that have purpose, meaning, that are intentional, and that are activities that we tend to continue and to extend. He wants us to focus on the activities that people engage in, the important activities, the ones that we spend effort to learn, the ones that have intention and purpose, the ones that tend to continue. We don't just learn them and drop them. We continue them. And then he will talk about what aspects of those activities are important and why they are important to think about developmentally. So, the defining criteria are three. It's an ongoing behavior. A molar activity, and the way he asked is, what molar activities are you engaging in? What are you spending your time trying to learn? What is important to you? And that's how I will ask. I'll ask you, as in exercise one, to describe and explain two activities that are important to you. Okay. So you'll be thinking about how that behavior is ongoing. It's not just something you do today and never do again, but it's something that goes on. It continues. Second criterion is that it has momentum of its own. And that is a way of saying that it's somehow important and we have some scheme in our minds about how this behavior or how this action, this activity will progress. Okay, so we want it to continue, or it tends to continue. If it has momentum. Momentum refers to energy. If I start moving quickly, I'm likely to keep going. You know that, you know. If I tripped and my feet stopped, the momentum of my motion would keep the upper part going and I would fall on my face. And so momentum refers to energy. And some of the things that we do tend to continue. We tend to continue them. And we know that something has momentum because if we get interrupted, we go back to it. If we're prevented from doing it, we get frustrated. We get annoyed. Don't keep me from doing that. That's how we know that it has momentum, that the activity itself has some energy. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily a physical activity. It means that it has psychological energy. It has a tendency to keep going. Newton, in his laws of physics, refers to things having momentum. An object at rest tends to stay at rest. Even if the alarm clock goes off, right? In the morning. An object at rest tends to stay at rest. An object in motion has momentum and tends to continue in motion until some force prevents it from moving. Friction, air resistance, an uphill slope. So momentum refers to the energy that underlies some activity and implies that if we start it, we tend to continue it. If it's interrupted, we tend to go back to it. So when you describe a molar activity, it's helpful to be able to describe what happens when you can't do it, or when you stop doing it, or when somebody asks you to stop doing it, when you're prevented from doing it, when you're interrupted. Lecturing is a molar activity. It has momentum. You've noticed that, right? I will just keep right on going, and I get frustrated with the clock. Because I want to keep on. There's stuff to explain. There's material to cover. There's stories to tell. There's understanding to evoke. So it tends to continue. And if I were prevented from lecturing, I will tell you what happens if I get sick and can't come, or if I get snowed in, which never happens, so don't count on it. It has never, ever happened. There has, in my 35 years here, been only one day when I lived in Underhill when I legitimately could have stayed home. But I didn't. I came in and lectured. Because my new cross-country skis were ready. So, okay. But otherwise, I will be here. And I will lecture as long as there's anybody here. Okay. So it has momentum. And I get frustrated if I can't continue. If I had to stop in the middle, I would be really upset. We'll probably look at several examples. But let me point out what you just said, which is that one of the things that having momentum might imply is that you can get behind on it. So something that has a schedule, something that you're expected to keep up with, is a nice example of a molar activity. And getting behind is frustrating, anxiety-producing, and that is evidence of the momentum of the activity. When you know you're behind on something, that almost implies, or does imply, that it has momentum. There's another question.
I have a question.
Like tapping your pen. That annoying nervous habit. Why do you get angry when somebody tells you to stop tapping your pen? What is the intent? Okay, what's the intent? The nervous twitch suggests that it has momentum, and the fact that you get frustrated if somebody won't let you do it suggests momentum. But what's the intent? To annoy?
No.
Okay, to practice your paradiddles? Any drummers in the crowd? Okay. Tapping your pen is a nervous habit. It's a molecular activity. It's annoying as hell. Clicking it. You ever been in a conversation where somebody's clicking, 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 clicking? That's a molecular activity. You don't have to learn to tap your pen. It doesn't really have any purpose. It's just a nervous habit. So it's a nice example of a molecular rather than molar activity. On the other hand, I have been in two situations where tapping your pen or a pencil would be a molar activity. And it's nice to have the example so that you can look at the contrast. One of those situations was a first grade classroom where every child had a pencil. And part of the lesson, the very important lesson, in motor control and inhibition and rhythmic activities that underlie reading, and this was actually part of the literacy program, was that the teacher would tap out rhythms with her pen. And the task for the children was to listen and to repeat the rhythms. And as a group. And this is a very important skill. So for them, because she had set it up the way she had, it was a molar activity. It was also an extremely difficult molar activity for some of those kids. And it's a very fundamental part of learning to read, to sit, to listen, to follow directions, to pay attention, to inhibit your behavior. It's a very important set of skills, and she had a very simple beginning routine, and then it goes from repeating the tap of the pencil to repeating sound and eventually to chanting and reading in unison. That's a whole year's worth of curriculum. The other situation was similar, except it was a group of adults and it was an introductory drumming class, and they didn't have sticks, but they were tapping out rhythms. Repeating rhythms, trying to stay in time and repeat the specifics. So those would be examples where tapping with the pen would be a molar activity because there was a purpose behind it. But just the nervous tapping that has no purpose is not a molar activity. Yes? I'm sorry. Because in fact, most of the time you don't think about it. The question is, why is breathing not a molar activity? For a very important next step reason. It's a very important activity. You do want to keep doing it. It does have momentum. It does have intent and keeps you going. But for the most part, you're not going to do anything with it. You're not going to teach other people to breathe. You're not going to breathe in any more sophisticated way. And right now I'm stepping into gray area because, in fact, some of you have spent considerable time and effort on a molar activity of breathing in a particular way. Yoga. Yoga breathing. From down here. Breathing, filling the lower cavity. It always makes me feel fat when I do that. molar activity of holding my gut in so I don't appear to be a teddy bear. So one of the places where, okay, let me back up. Breathing is probably a molar activity for the first 2 minutes of your life, your life after birth. Okay? You need to do it. And it takes some effort. And it sure has intent and purpose at that point. But then it stops being molar. Once you've got it down and you don't have to think about it anymore, unless you're interrupted in it, now, there is some momentum there, isn't there, if you're interrupted. Watch my ears turn blue. There will be intent there. It is something that can get more complex as you learn yoga breathing, or any of you do continuous breathing, playing a musical instrument or singing? Any of you do circular breathing? Have any of you tried to learn circular breathing? You play the trumpet. Do you do circular breathing? Okay. How easy was that to learn? Oh! Oh, yeah. Do you have to pay attention?
Most of the time, yeah. When you get the hang of it, it kind of comes naturally, but then at times you'll forget.
Yeah.
You'll be like, oh, I forgot to breathe now.
Yeah, right. Forgetting to breathe. Okay. Can you, in 10 words or less, explain circular breathing? Breathing in and out at the same time. In through your nose, out through your mouth, so that you are literally taking air in, usually through your nose, while you are continuing the sound, which is produced by moving that column of air through the trumpet, through the didgeridoo, through the clarinet. It's a very interesting challenge to try to do. I recommend that if you really want to appreciate breathing and you really want to appreciate what musicians learn, try it. Try expelling air steadily or intermittently if you're playing notes through your mouth while you bring air in through your nose at the same time. It's a molar activity. Clearly a molar activity. Okay, is breathing a molar activity? I'm going to call it a gray area. But what it does is illustrate a couple of things. One is, if you're just talking about everyday breathing, after the first couple of minutes, once you've got it down, it's no longer a molar activity. When you make it more complex, as in yoga breathing or circular breathing, then it becomes a molar activity because you're, in fact, expanding, extending, complicating that activity in an intentional and purposeful way. And the learning of that skill may have a great deal of momentum. I have watched people work on it for months and months and months to try to get it every day. To try to get the circular breathing. And some of us never do. I haven't worked on it that hard. It's one of those challenges. Kind of like, rub your tummy and pat your head at the same time. I got that one down in grade school. But circular breathing, I've never got. I don't tango very well either. The important implication of what I just said about gray area is that what we're really interested in, when we talk about molar activities, is activities that might become part of something more complex. But one of the characteristics of many of the activities that start out molar, such as breathing in the first 2 minutes of post-natal life, is that we may work very hard to master them early on, and then we never have to think about them again. They are molar while we are working on them. And then they may stop being molar. And I would say everyday breathing is one of those. Unless we try to do it in some unusual way or unusual place. What Bronfenbrenner is going to challenge us to do is to look at how a molar activity that may be the focus of our learning at a particular point then becomes molecular because we have combined it with other activities to create something that is larger. So it gets subsumed. It's a good word. Subsumed. Incorporated into under something bigger. Okay. I've ignored a couple of questions. Let me take those and then go on. Sex. Ongoing? In your dreams, I hope. I hope for all of you. Unless you take a vow of celibacy, I hope for all of you an ongoing molar activity of sexuality. Momentum? Sure. You get annoyed if the phone rings in the middle before? Right. Some of us don't answer the phone. Okay. Intent? Meaning? And if you have meaningless sex, don't. Don't. Just don't. If it doesn't have meaning for you, I'll let you choose your own meaning, but don't have meaningless sex. Yuck. Yes, sex is a wonderful example of a molar activity. And it has the potential to become increasingly complex over time. Some aspects of it become molecular, you don't have to worry about them. You don't have to think about them. And the activity gets more complex, so incorporating aspects of the sexual acts into a larger framework of pleasure and sexuality is a potential. And it may very quickly go or very slowly, actually. I don't know why I put the time frame in there. The potential is there for sexual activity to go from being the very central focus in a relationship, you know, so that you're focused on, will I get laid tonight? And so that's really the important thing. And all of your effort goes into that. You know, all the invitation, the seduction, the paying for dinner, whatever it is that you do, all is focused on this, will I? I had a straight face until you... Okay. And then if you're thoughtful, intelligent, responsible, fortunate, emotionally intelligent, that central question of will I get laid becomes incorporated into a much more complex activity called maintaining the romance, passion, sensuality, and mutuality of my long-term committed relationship. And the question is not, will I get laid tonight? But how's my relationship going? And what do we both want at this point? And how can we arrange our lives so that we have this very satisfying, very complex, very loving, very mutual, very intentional and fun sensual and sexual activity? I'm just deciding which direction I want to go. I mean, that's a hard question to follow. Yeah, I'm going to go this way. Some of us would argue that the sexuality ought to be added slowly to that larger molar activity, that the relationship stuff ought to come first. And then the sexuality gets incorporated bit by bit into that. Probably doesn't describe your first year at UVM, but it should. Next time you start over, do it the right way. Work on relationship first instead of starting with meaningless sex and then trying to turn it into something meaningful. Okay, off that. Yes? I would think swallowing would be one of those like breathing. You know, you get something in there, you need to swallow to keep from choking on it. Once you've got it, it's probably a little less clearly molecular than breathing, because once you get the lungs opened up, and you know, it's just pretty much the same. But kids have to learn to swallow different kinds of substances. So you start swallowing milk and on a liquid diet for the first several months, and then you add mushed up bananas or whatever, and work on up to steak. I'm not going there. I'm not... Okay. So swallowing might become more complex, and it is also something that some people don't learn to do on a regular basis, and so sometimes people have to go through training programs to learn to swallow. Some of you know kids who drool, and one of the things that you can do is teach a child systematically to swallow the saliva instead of letting it run out. I used to work with a guy who had never learned to swallow his own saliva. He produced too much of it, and so he always had a mouthful of saliva, which was made it dangerous to work too close to it, because when he talked, he sprayed. And he would occasionally drool. Perfectly reasonable adult with a PhD. He hadn't gotten that one down. Hadn't gotten it. Okay, I don't want to spend an awful lot of time splitting hairs or deciding where the exact dividing line is between whether something is molecular or molar. It's important to ask those questions because it brings out what is important about them. What I want to focus on is the criteria that the activities that we're interested in, the activities that are important in development, that eventually become the skills that you use to maintain and to engage your environment and to explore it. Okay. Those are big molar activities from the definition of human development. Exploring your environment, maintaining your environment, engaging in the environment, those are big molar activities. And they go on most of your life. What Brontë-Brenner focuses us on is the activities that are ongoing, that have intent and purpose and meaning and have purpose, have the momentum. That was the other one. Okay. So think about activities that clearly have those, and then add to that the possibility that a behavior activity may be molar, something that you're focused on, and then gradually become molecular because you begin to focus on a larger activity that subsumes it. And circular breathing is one, yoga breathing is another, but let me go to a much more complex one. Much more complex one. I spend time as an infant, really hard time, learning to stand up. Learning to pull myself up on the furniture, on my dad, on my mom, on my big brother, grab things, stand up, and I spend weeks intently figuring out how to alternately flex and extend my legs. I need to do that. Moving my weight from one side to the other. Learning the postural movement. If you notice, I'm holding my hands gripped because I'm holding on to something while I'm doing this. And that's part of it. And when I let go, I fall over. Because I'm spending my time figuring out how my lower limbs and my torso work. And this is a molar activity. Kids who are engaged in this learning, infants who are learning this, trying to move up toward being toddlers, will wake themselves up in the middle of the night and practice. And sometimes they will do it in their sleep. And they will do it until they are totally exhausted. Some of you have heard my story of taking care of Kevin, the kid upstairs, when I was a graduate student. His mother was a graduate student. His parents were both graduate students. And I took care of Kevin during that period of time when he would get up. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd hear Kevin whimpering. And you'd go in, and here would be Kevin hanging on to the edge of the crib. And he'd gotten up, and I'm assuming he was still asleep when he got up. This was such an important molar activity. He needed to learn to do it. But he had a problem. He hadn't learned to let go. The palmar grasp reflex is there for a reason. It's so you can learn to stand up, and other reasons too. But you hang on until you're totally exhausted and you're whimpering, and then you get an adult to come in and pry your fingers up and hold on to your hands and tip you back so you will fold. And you would do that at 2 o'clock in the morning. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, you'd hear, and there would be Kevin trying to sleep, standing up, practicing. Okay. He got it. He learned it. But during that period of time, it was a very important molar activity. I suspect the rest of his life, he would now be 40. Yeah, he would now be 40. I suspect that now he doesn't... Well, he's probably reaching another point in his life when getting up, standing upright, and staying upright may become molar again. That's a very serious point when you get older. My mother uses a walker, and she gets up okay, but... Anyway, the point is that Kevin spent a lot of energy learning to stand up. Then you get to the point where you want to get up, you just get up. You don't worry about it, you don't think about it, it doesn't take any more energy than physically it takes to get up. You've got it down cold. And then you're up and you can start cruising. And you can hang on to things. And then you put that standing up together with another activity, which is a really important one, which is going from shifting your weight from one side to the other to actually picking that one foot up while you're hanging on. taking your weight off one foot and standing on one foot. Okay, that becomes a molar activity. Alternating. Why do you need to do that? Because you got to pick one up to move it. Okay. If you're going to go sideways, you got to get all your weight on one foot. Okay. And if you're going to turn and go this way, if you don't shift all of your weight onto one foot, you're never going to walk. Walking then becomes the molar activity. Cruising. And then you can drop your hand. And then walking is the molar activity. And now it's not a molar activity. I can walk. Then climbing stairs becomes the molar activity. And then running becomes the molar activity. And running up the stairs becomes the molar activity. And then playing soccer becomes the molar activity. You don't think about walking when you're playing soccer. If you're playing it well. You don't think about the running. That gets incorporated into the dribbling, the shooting, the blocking, the tackling. It gets all incorporated into something that's much larger. And then it gets incorporated with other formerly molar activities into the strategy of the game. Okay, now we're on defense. How do I do that? And so it gets combined with the cognitive activity. So for Bronfenbrenner, what's important is what happens over time to the molar activity. And the assumption is that you're going to construct more complex activities out of those activities that were once molar. And as you incorporate them into something bigger, what's important is the bigger activity, not the building blocks that led up to it. So the activities that are going to be important to think about are the ones that have the potential to be incorporated into a more complex activity over time. Everything you do that's important to you is, from a constructivist point of view, constructed out of smaller activities that have been combined. And over the course of development, the continual combining of those smaller units into more complex activities and the coordination of those with other complex activities is what you're really interested in. It may be important that a kid learns to stand up. It surely is. But he's not going to win the Heisman for standing up. He's not going to letter in football for standing up. The rewards are going to come from the much more complex activities, the accomplishments that we're going to be looking for in adolescence or adulthood are the more complex activities. And what we're interested in is whether the kid has the opportunity to develop the molar activities and then to construct them into something more complex. And for Bronfenbrenner, the complexity of those molar activities as you develop becomes the central focus in understanding your development. What you do is action. You act in the world. Do you act in the world in a 6-year-old way? You act in the world in a 26-year-old way. What defines something as a 6-year-old way? Can you read the textbook? Can you do exercise number one? Can you apply the information that you read to understand development? Taking a course in college is a very complex activity. It requires a lot of actions, activities that you probably don't think very much about. But successfully passing a course in college is an incredibly complex activity. And it's made up of hundreds of little bits of things that used to be important. But reading a word, being able to spell cat, which was very important in kindergarten, doesn't seem so important now when you compare it to understanding Bronfenbrenner's scheme. But learning to spell cat was part of what got you there. So the question is, learning language in the first place is a very important and very complex molar activity. Learning to speak a language, any language, is a very complex molar activity. And when we try to learn a second or third, that becomes an important molar activity. Making ourselves understood in a language that we're learning as adults is a very complex molar activity. And overcoming or acquiring an accent that allows us to get rid of one or leave one behind or connect this one to an original language and not apply all of the pronunciation habits and rules that we have in our first language to the second one because it has different ones. It's a very complex molar activity. And presumably, in your case, it has some intent. It's ongoing, right? It has intent. It has meaning for you. Momentum. You keep doing it. You keep practicing. It's a good example. Right. The question is, does a molar activity have to be positive? And the answer is absolutely not. The example I think I gave in the book is maintaining a heroin addiction is a very complex activity. And it's a molar activity. Some of you have spent time learning to inhale tobacco smoke. Right? That's a molar activity. I remember it well. But it was very important to be able to inhale because otherwise they laughed at me when I was 15. The guys I worked with all smoked, and one of the purposes of working in the summer was to learn to smoke. And then it became more complex. You learn to French inhale. And even thinking about it makes my nose hurt. What happens when a heroin addiction, well, a heroin addiction will never become second nature. Never, ever. Unless you have a lifetime supply. If you have a lifetime supply, the developmental trajectory for a drug addict is that a great deal of your time and energy goes into figuring out where the next fix is coming from. And having enough money to, or enough intelligence to scam somebody to get the money to. So that will never become molecular. It'll never become something you don't have to think about. The difficulty with drug addiction, particularly and alcoholism too, to some extent, is that the complex activities that you master in order to maintain it spill over into other parts of your life. And even if you are no longer, for example, a heroin addict, you have probably spent years learning to scam people, learning not to take responsibility for your behavior, learning to lie, learning to manipulate, and it's one thing to get over the withdrawal and stop needing the heroin. It's quite another thing to learn a different set of ways of relating to people in ways that you can trust. The difficulty with behaviors such as drinking or inhaling tobacco is that you change the body and you develop a need for, you know, an addiction to the substance. And that gives it its momentum, that you have to keep doing it, because if you don't, you start to hurt. That you've changed the body chemistry then in doing that.
What about like smoking cigarettes becoming molecular, like you wake up in the morning and you're like, your body thinks about it?
Yeah. That's a nice example, and I think that's where you were going, that you don't think about it, you just keep doing it. I'm sorry, I kind of got off track on that one. The heroin addiction part always pushes a tape up here, and I do that. Things like inhaling do become molecular. It was molar when I was trying to do it, trying to learn to do it. Once I had learned to do it, piece of cake. And then I didn't have to think about it, and then I could just keep right on inhaling and light a cigarette. In fact, I had that experience. A couple of things made me quit. Actually, many things made me quit, and I quit many times. But when I finally quit the last year that I was smoking, one of the things that made me quit was that I couldn't keep up with my 8-year-old son walking. I couldn't keep up with him. So this didn't seem terribly good for our relationship to have my 8-year-old running circles around me. This wasn't good for my ego. So cigarettes were hurting my ego at that point. And the other was that I had on a couple of occasions that same year the experience of leaving a cigarette in the ashtray on my desk and lighting another one and starting to tap the ash off the one that I had just lit and realized that I had another one there. It was so second nature that it stopped having purpose, except there they were, so you just smoked them until they were all gone and then you went and got some more. And yeah. And that's why I quit. I lit my last one on July 1st, 1980. I didn't finish it.
Driving.
Nice example. Driving starts off as a molar activity.
Yes.
Grinding gears, remembering, you know, the directional signal is on the left. Right. Windshield wipers on my car. Windshield wipers are on the right. Gear shift on my, I had a H on the stock. Clutch, brake, gas, 2 feet, 3 pedals. And while you were shifting, you had to remember to let out the clutch and put it in and then let it out. And remember that there were other cars here beside you, and therefore you had to pay attention to where you... It's a molar activity. Learning to drive a vehicle is a molar activity. And over time, it has the potential to become quite molecular, so that people can drive for hours and not actually think very much about what they're doing. I remember, and this is another way in which it's molecular, that getting the opportunity to drive at 16 was the molar activity, kind of like getting my fix. I had to have the, where can I get a car? What excuse can I have? Sure, I'll take my little sister to school, any place she wants to go, you know. In order to get, that got old after a while. It stopped being something that I really wanted to do. And then it became a chore after a while. And then it gets incorporated into, okay, I want to go to Albuquerque to visit my grandchildren, I'm going to drive. And you want to pay attention enough so that you're where you need to be and you don't want to hit things, but you can have a conversation while you're driving. I don't recommend cell phones while you're driving. I really don't. It annoys me that some people think they don't have to think about their driving. And to have them aiming for me while they're talking on the phone. I am in favor of the law that will make you pull over and stop rather than have your phone stuck in your ear. Now that's a safety issue. But driving does become molecular after a while, I think. And it's fun for me because I move back and forth between a stick shift and an automatic. And so there are these moments when it needs to be molar because I need to remember which car I'm in. I do these fun things of driving the stick shift for 2 or 3 days, and then I get in the automatic and I come up to a stop sign and put the clutch in. Except that when I put the clutch in, it has the wide brake pedal. Right. Slam, I'm in the steering wheel because I've put the brakes on rather than put the clutch in. There isn't a clutch in that one. So it needs to become molar again because it's important to make that switch from car to car so that I do the right thing. How many of you have gone to St. John? New Zealand, Japan, England, having learned to drive in the U.S. Driving becomes a molar activity again. On the left. On the left. And one of my favorite experiences driving in St. John was coming over a hill, and there was a, I'm sure she was from the University of New Hampshire, there was a car full of students, and she was on my side. And she did the unfortunate thing. I had just enough warning. She did the unfortunate thing that sometimes people do when they realize they are on the wrong side of the road and there's a car coming at them. Anybody know what she did? It's a reflex. Took both hands off the wheel and covered her face. Fortunately, the person in the other seat grabbed the wheel to keep her from wandering all over. But she bailed. She just said, "I'm not here." She was prepared to take care of my rental car, but we missed her. But it was quite an interesting experience. Oh yeah, she forgot to make that a molar activity of driving on the other side of the road. My wife is currently in New Zealand, and she's not driving. Somebody offered her his car to drive, his new Jaguar convertible. And she had the good sense to say, "No way, I'm not getting behind the wheel. Not happening." The celebrity chef offered her his Jaguar. Not doing that. Yes?
I'm still a little bit confused. So
okay. A molar activity is something that you probably do learn to do, and while you are learning it, it is clearly a molar activity. Then the question is it still molar once you've learned to do it? Not if it's not becoming more complex. Okay. As long as you're still working on it, practicing it, incorporating it into something else, then it's still molar. Until you don't have to think about it anymore, then it's probably become molecular. It has that potential. So for Bronfenbrenner, what he does with this notion of molar activity is going back to the notion of how complex and how diverse are they. And he suggests that one of the ways you can assess a person's developmental maturity, developmental status, is by looking at the complexity and variety of the molar activities that the person engages in. So when I said, "Do you behave like a 6-year-old? Or do you behave like a 26-year-old? Do you engage the world as a 6-year-old learning to spell, or a 26-year-old learning Bronfenbrenner's scheme, or writing a book, or selling insurance?" For Bronfenbrenner, that difference is not, it's not the age that makes the difference. The difference is, what kind of activities do you engage in on your own? On your own. What can you do when nobody's telling you what to do? What do you do? How complex are your activities in engaging your environment? Do you have a pretty simple, limited repertoire of things that you do? Bronfenbrenner would say that's less well developed than a person who has a variety of things that are complex that he or she does. And again, all of these are in the book, so you don't have to copy them down. But this is an important point for him, that if we're going to focus on activities, and we want to look at the ones that have intent and momentum, and that have the potential to become more complex, then one way to think about maturity or developmental status, how highly you are developed, is to look at the activities that you engage in, and especially the activities that you engage in when you're on your own. Exercise one. What do we want? Describe. This is in the syllabus. Remember, it's due Monday. Describe two important activities that you engage in. Molar activities. That means tell us what they are, what you do. We would like them to be two different ones. Okay, so you give us two examples. Explain how they satisfy the criteria of molarity. And in that explanation, make it clear to us that you understand the criteria, which is that it's an ongoing behavior. It has momentum, so we'd like you to tell us how you know it has momentum. How do you know it has momentum? What happens when somebody keeps you from doing it, or when you can't do it, or when you stop doing it? And what is its intent? What is its meaning to you? She's not looking.
So what if, you know, you're engaging in a molar activity and gradually it becomes molecular, but the activity itself, what you're interacting with, becomes like more difficult, like say a crossword puzzle or a video game,
yep,
or something. You know, what is it still molar?
Yes, the example is a nice one of a molar activity of doing crossword puzzles. Learning to do a crossword puzzle, learning how they're set up, is molar at the beginning. It tends to stay molar because every puzzle is different. If you reach the point where you've picked up a fourth grader's puzzle book and you just whip through it, and you don't have to think about it, then that particular one probably isn't very important. Then we would ask why you were doing it. But if you're doing the Burlington Free Press puzzles every day, what happens is that the vocabulary changes and you continually run into puzzles that are structured differently, puzzle makers who have different assumptions, and although you've learned to do the puzzle, kind of like learning to read, you can keep going on to more and more complex puzzles, or the puzzle content gets more difficult. So it stays molar. It stays molar. Some people move on in puzzles to making their own puzzles, and then that's a different activity. Okay. Have fun with it. We'll see you on Monday.
Hi. I was